welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Please give a big round of applause for Fritz Onion.
Thank you, and welcome all to today's session. I want to make a couple notes before we get started. We're going to be talking about the new features of ASP.NET 4.0, and I will make available all of the demos that I'm presenting today throughout the discussion at this link right here, which I will also post at the end of the talk in case you don't get it right now. And that link is just Pluralsight, link.pluralsight.com/techdays10 ASP.NET 4. So I will upload the demos later this evening, so you should be able to grab them with that link. Great. Well, thanks for coming. My name is Fritz Onion. I'm one of the co-founders of a company called Pluralsight. We do .NET developer training in classroom formats, and we also have a subscription-based online training service where all of our authors have recorded their training courses, and we make them available on a subscription basis. I did want to mention as well, I have a number of free trials for our subscription to Pluralsight On Demand. First come, first serve after the talk, just come up and ask me for one of these cards, and you get a free week trial to the subscription service. If you haven't met me before, I'm the author of a couple books on ASP.NET, Essential ASP.NET and Essential ASP.NET 2, contributing editor to MSDN Magazine. And I speak at various conferences around the world. I'm an MVP for ASP.NET. And here's my contact information. If you want to drop me a line, it's just fritz@pluralsight.com. And my blog is pluralsight.com/fritz. And my Twitter feed, if you want to see what I was eating for breakfast this morning, is Fritz Onion. Okay. So we have a lot of ground to cover here in ASP.NET version 4. Now, I assume everyone out there is an ASP.NET developer. That's why you're here. Could I just get a quick show of hands to verify that? How many of you are actively using ASP.NET? Excellent. Okay. So when I say things, when I talk about view state and list views, you're not going to be wondering what I'm discussing. So we're really just going to focus on what exactly is new in the upcoming release of ASP.NET coming next month with Visual Studio 2010. So I have a rather long laundry list of features to look at here. Instead of enumerating them as part of the intro, I think we'll just jump in, and you'll see them as we go along. So let me start with a brief introduction to Visual Studio 2010. I'm not going to be spending much time talking about the IDE, but it's a couple things are worth mentioning just off the bat. One is, those of you that are using ASP.NET 3.5 SP1, right now when you create a website, like I'm doing here, I'll just create a sample site, the configuration file that you get with 3.5 SP1 is rather long because they had to include references to all of these additional assemblies that they shipped with .NET 3.5, and they needed to include that in the local config file because .NET 3.5 was not an official new release of .NET. It was really an additive release with additional libraries that were included. So this is different in .NET 4. .NET 4 is a brand new release of the framework, so our configuration files now look like this. Does that feel good? So nice and short, only what you need. It does set the target framework to 4.0, which we'll talk about in a bit. If you want to retarget to 3.5, you can do that very easily. So that's the first thing. Right, the config file is much smaller, which is a welcome change. The other thing they've added, which is kind of nice as well, is when you create a new project, if you don't use the empty web template, let's just use the standard website template here, web with template. You'll notice that it spits out a rather verbose application consisting of a number of styles and a default page, and it's got links in for authentication with forms-based authentication. And if you look at the application, notice it looks very similar, if you've done the MVC stuff before, very similar to the default application you get when you run or create a new ASP.NET MVC application. So we actually have a really nice symmetry going on now between ASP.NET MVC and ASP.NET Web Forms, in the sense that you get a full-featured application out of the box that has a menuing system, and it's got authentication and authorization built in. And it's very easy just to add a lot of features too quickly if you want to use this styling. The other nice thing about the styling is it's all CSS-based, just like the MVC version, so it's easy to tweak the colors and look and feel. However, I predict that a lot of new sites are going to come on the web this year that have this blue header and a home and an about box in the top. What do you guys think? Something about the wizards that Microsoft produces tend to show up on the web. Okay, some other features that were added. IntelliSense enhancements to JavaScript. So if you're working in JavaScript inside of the IDE, you'll find it a bit more intuitive. And perhaps more importantly, they've added a number of snippets. So if you're working in the markup mode, let me just go full screen here. How many of you avoid the designer, that you really just work in the markup, right? Quite a few of you, okay. How many of you live only in the designer? I'm just curious. You really just use the designer, drag and drop? Okay, much smaller percentage. Yeah, I find that's generally true. Most developers I know prefer to work in the markup directly. One of the disadvantages of doing that, of course, is that you lose access to the templated controls that are just dropped on for you in the designer. And so one thing they've done here is notice there are these new snippets in the editor with a whole bunch of HTML snippets available. And you'll notice there are two different types there, one with the yellow box and the angle brackets and a little notepad indicator next to it, and the other one is just a pure notepad indicator. And the notepad indicator means that it's a code snippet, traditional code snippet that generates the whole template output for you. And the other one is sort of a combination. You can either use it just to spit out the element directly, or you can actually hit the tab to activate the code snippet and let that go as well. So if I just start typing button and hit tab, it spits out the whole text, run at server, etc. I could do the same thing with text box or text area, tab. Let's give this an ID, TB1. And then here's another nice feature. If you look at, say, required field validator, notice this fills in a couple of fields nicely for you. It automatically fills in control to validate with previous control ID. So you can type this stuff into the editor and give yourself a fair amount of assistance in putting them together. And there are also things for like image tags, et cetera, and it will spit out all the attributes for you like you might hope. So a lot of enhancements for the text-based editing experience for ASP.NET and HTML. And then, as we'll see, there's additional support for CSS. One of the things they really focused on in this release was to make sure the controls that they have built render proper CSS, and they don't render improper inline styles and a lot of other things people have complained about over the years. And they've also added improved understanding of CSS within the IDE. So you'll notice that the IntelliSense is better, and it actually is standards compliant. Okay, so let's dig into some new features. By far the biggest feature, in my opinion, of ASP.NET 4.0 is the addition of routing. So routing was introduced into the framework in .NET in the 3.5 SP1 release in August of 2008. And it was released primarily for MVC. But there were ways that you could use routing in a web forms application. So you could actually take advantage of the route table and have it dispatch onto an ASP.NET endpoint, but it involved a bit of work. You actually had to go instantiate the page class yourself and have it process the request. So there was the middle layer was missing between the route table and the actual page endpoints. And that's what they addressed in 4.0. But I'm just curious, how many of you have used routing in a web forms application in version 3.5? Anyone at all? One or two. Yeah, not too many. So it was a bit of work to get going. So what the example I have on the slide here is simply an MVC route. So if you've used MVC before, this all looks very familiar. And basically the way routes work is you define the route name right here. You define the URL template that you want this route to match, including placeholder variables, which are the curly brace indicators. And then, so this is going to match any URL with three segments, and it's going to map the controller as the first part, the action as the second part, and the ID as the third part. And this is used. This is the default route that is installed for you when you generate a new MVC application. So how do we do something similar in web forms with ASP.NET? So in 4.0, they introduce a new HTTP handler that is capable of dispatching requests routed to the route table onto ASPX endpoints, so web form files. And they've also added a new bucket to the request object called request context, and this gives you access to route information, because one of the things you're typically going to want to do when you get a request coming in from a route table is to be able to pluck out the values that were in the URL and use them as parameters in your page. So you can do that through the route table, route data property of the page class. And then here's the exact function you want to use to map a route in the route table to an ASP.NET web forms endpoint. So you just call system.web.routing.routetable.routes.mapPageRoute. So there's a new function on there called mapPageRoute. Give it the name of the route you want to map to. Give it the actual string you want it to map to. What is the URL you want it to map to? And then give it the physical endpoint, the ASPX file that you want it to map to. So let me just demonstrate how to do this. So we have a standard ASP.NET application here. And I do have an about page already in place. But if we run the about page the way we currently have it set up, the endpoint is, of course, the traditional physical file.aspx endpoint. So what I could do is come up with my own routing scheme. Basically, I could define my own URL layer on top of my existing site. And this is really what routing in ASP.NET 4 lets you do. It lets you define a completely new URL scheme and layer it on top of an existing ASP.NET application. So let's go into the global ASX, and I'm going to put this into application start, which is typically where you want to do these things. And let's go ahead and do the routing route table. So route table, and we're going to say routes. Map page route. Okay, so map page route takes the route name, and we're actually defining a new route in the route table here. So let's just call this the about route. And let's go ahead and specify the URL, which we just want to be about. So this is what comes after the first slash after your virtual directory name. And then the physical file is the ASP.NET endpoint you want to map to. So tildewhack about.aspx. Okay, so exactly what we had in the slide there. And what this will let us do, my helper function was not, let me just comment this out for now. Okay, so let's go now to just about. So if I go to slash about, that should go to the new route table entry and map onto the about.aspx endpoint. And of course, I could have said anything, right? I could have called it foobar, whatever you want. I could have given it nested structure. It's important to note that this is different from the 2.0 URL rewriting scheme they introduced. So URL rewriting, this is not URL rewriting, right? They're not actually changing the URL on the fly. This is actually constructing the endpoint, the physical page, and letting that serve as the request handler on the back end. So it's pure routing, exactly what most people are looking for. Okay, so that's the very basic. You can just walk in and add as many of these routes as you want to. You can do it on a per-file basis. Let's talk a little bit more about how you might use this in a parameterized context. So instead of just mapping onto a single page, you might want to do something like have a courses page that used to take a query string, and maybe you want to use a URL to specify a course ID in this case. So what you can do here is, as part of the route definition, you can use the placeholders, like I'm doing here. So I can say, I want to go to the courses URL slash some variable, which is course name in this case, and I want that to map onto courses.aspx. So what I'm implying here is that once I get into courses.aspx, I'm going to go look at the value in the course name route data and pluck that out. So of course, that's part of the URL, but the route mechanism is going to put that into the route data. So you can extract it when you get to the page, much like you might extract a query string, but in this case, it's part of the URL. So let's just try that real quick. So I'm going to go back here and add a courses table, whoops, right at the top level. So we'll call this courses. And we'll choose a master page since we're in an environment that has one. And then inside of our route table, let's go add the entry that I just described. So similar to what we just did, but this one's going to be to courses.aspx. And we're going to specify courses slash placeholder course name, like so. OK, and then when we get into our course page, you want to pull out the value. Right? So let's go into the course page, and let's put in, say, a label here so we can print out the information. No text initially, and set an ID equal to course name. And I'm going to specify a larger font size so we can see this thing, like so. And then let's just go to the code behind, and if I got navigated to via that routing mechanism, I should be able to reach into the route data and pluck that out. So I can say course name.text is equal to page, we're already on page, route data indexed by course name. Okay, and we'll cast that to a string. Okay, so route data dot value, sorry. Okay, so if we run that, notice that I'm, oh yes, you have to have distinct route names. So when you do your copy and paste, make sure you change your route names, otherwise it gets mad. So this is my courses route. Lovely. So I'm actually on the courses page now, but I didn't get there using the route table. This is actually a very important point to note while we're here. And that point is physical files, the actual ASP.NET endpoints that you have in your application, still are valid navigable endpoints. So using the route table is not an either-or situation, it's a both situation. You get both the route table mappings and you have the traditional file-based system in place. If you want to, and in fact, the physical files override the route table. So if you happen to have a route table entry that was courses.aspx, this physical file would override it and you would get mapped onto here first. So keep that in mind as you layer your URL scheme on top of it, that those things are there. If you want to prevent it, you could, of course, add some authorization settings or add route or specify that they should return 404s. So let's do courses slash ASP.NET, like so. And notice my URL looks like this. I was able to extract that last section of the URL from the route data. Okay? So very easy to work with. Basically, all you need to do is go through and define these route table entries, map them onto the physical files, and then you can come up with a brand new URL scheme on top of your entire site. Okay, there are a couple other little enhancements they added to make the dealing with the route data a little easier, one of which is a pair of route expression builders. And these are just traditional expression builders. I don't know if you've run across them before, but there's one for extracting values from resource files. It's the percent dollar sign syntax, right, to reach into the resource file. So they added a new expression builder, two of them, one called route value and one called route URL. And route value lets you declaratively reach into the route data on a page and extract an element. So instead of doing it by hand like I did earlier, I could use this dollar route value access. In fact, we can do that real quick. If I just replace my label here with another one or add another one, like so, and we'll just specify the text to be equal to this expression syntax, and then we'll specify route value colon course name. So route value colon course name. And that should give us the same rendering that we did by hand in our code behind, so courses, ASP.NET, like so. And notice they both render the same route data value. Okay, so there's a declarative way to do that. And then the other thing that's useful in terms of dealing with route data is as soon as you introduce this URL scheme on top of your physical ASP.NET site, you typically want to be careful about how you specify anchor tags. How do you link from one page to another? Because you know you probably don't want to use the ASPX files anymore. You want to stick to the entries in your route table. But the problem is if you stick to the entries in the route table, you'll find yourself hard-coding those paths within your anchor tags throughout the site. And you probably don't want to do the hard coding because if you ever go back and change things in the route table in terms of what URL maps onto what endpoints, they'll be off, right? So the solution to that is they've added a route URL expression builder right here. And this is somewhat analogous to the ASP.NET MVC action link, if you've used that before. So this just says route URL, here's the route name that I want you to map onto. Courses route in this case. Here's the data for the route that I want you to pass as well, and that will just go to the route, supply the variables as you specified them, and generate the appropriate link when you get to the client. So not a good idea to use the route URL instead of hard coding these paths as you introduce routes into your system. Okay, one other thing you can use, if you're doing any data binding, so I'm sure a lot of you have done this before where you've prepared a SQL data source or an object data source, and you've specified a parameter to come in from the query string, say, or perhaps session, and you want that to map into a parameter within your data source query to influence the result set. So you can do that with all different types of things, right, controls and session values and profile values. So what they did here is they added a new route parameter version. So you can drop this in, and this will simply key off of whatever route variable you specified. Here's the route key. And it will reach into the route data, pluck that out, and then use that as a parameter for the data source. Okay. So you can use these in pretty much any scenario that makes sense for you. Now, the one question that often comes up when I show people this is if we go back to our route table, I've so far mapped two entries, and I did one entry per physical file that I had in my system. How many of you have more than 50 physical ASPX pages in your site? Almost everyone, right? Sure. So any reasonable size site that's actually a real site is going to have a large number of these things. And it's kind of up to you how you want to define the routes, like I said, but it can be rather tedious to go through and actually define a single route for every single physical endpoint that you have in your system, which is sort of the naive way to do it. But it turns out you can use variable placeholders, too, to do this generically for an entire directory structure if you want to. So imagine you had a, or imagine I was mapping to, I wanted to map a URL scheme from slash home slash some page name onto a page that was up in my root directory system, right under the virtual directory. You could do that with the following syntax. So this would cover every single file in my root directory if someone referenced it using home slash page name. And notice I didn't use the .aspx extension because I wanted to strip those off. Most people shifting into a new URL scheme tend to want to drop off the ASPX extensions just because your scheme looks cleaner and it gives you more flexibility down the road. So in this case, you can just use these two, this variable placeholder in your route description, and you can reference the route, the variable placeholder in the actual file mapping. Okay, so this will say any file that is in the root directory, let people map onto it with home slash the name of the file. So keep that in mind as you sort of lay out your new scheme, is that you can create a single entry that might account for many different files or many different endpoints in your system if that's something you're trying to do. Okay, one last tidbit on the routing stuff. Beware that routing, by default, authorization checks in your configuration file are going to apply to physical files only if you navigate to the physical files. So what I've seen a lot of people do with this is they set up a new routing structure, and they've already got authorization specified, right, because they had the site already built, and they got authorization specified for all of their physical files, so you know who's allowed to access which physical files in your system. The problem is, As soon as you layer on that new URL scheme on top of your physical file system, you are using different URLs, and that authorization stuff is URL-based. So by default, your new URL scheme does not do any authorization check on the physical endpoint that you're mapping to. And maybe that's what you want, in which case, just go with it and then add your own entries in the configuration file for doing authorization against the new URL scheme. However, if you already have a bunch of authorization in place, you might consider setting this flag right here. Change it to red. Right here. So there's an optional last parameter to the map page route function. And this says, please apply any access control rules that are defined in my configuration file to the physical file that is actually being used to service this request. So that's a nice shortcut where if you already have all of your authorization defined in your ASP.NET application, you don't have to redefine it in terms of the new URL structure. You can just let the physical files remain the defining factor for the authorization. So keep that in mind. Okay, so what else do we have? Well, they've added a feature for view state. How many of you ASP.NET developers spend time trimming your view state down, trying to keep it small? Okay, the rest of you, you should start doing this. It's definitely something you want to keep in mind, right? View state can get very large very quickly if you're not careful, especially if you're doing data binding, using data binding controls in your application. And one of the frustrating things about the way view state works in 3.5 and earlier, let's just go to our default page here, is that if I wanted to, in fact, I'm going to do this here. I'm going to put something on that generates a bunch of view state, which, of course, a data binding operation will do very nicely for us. And let's turn on paging so we can actually see it. Okay, so, and then let's do one more thing, which is I want to put something in here that actually relies on view state and is going to break if view state is disabled. So I'm going to put in a label, like so, give it an initial value of 0, an ID equal to some label. And in my code behind, just to show you how I could do something to rely on view state, I'm going to do an int.parse of whatever's in the current label, so some label.text, and I'm going to take that result and add 1 to it, and I'm going to set it back into the label text. So some label.text is equal to that.toString. Okay, so all I'm doing is every single time this page is hit, I'm reading in the value of the label, and I'm incrementing it because it's an integer, which I guarantee right here. And every time the page posts back, I should actually see that incremented to the next value if view state is enabled properly. So here's the scenario, right? Here's the scenario. You've got a page which has a fair amount of view state on it, like we do here. Okay, notice I have to scroll. Fair amount. And there's my span. Let's try to do something that posts back so we can see it increment. Okay, it's incrementing. Notice we're up to 3 now because I posted back 3 times. So it's successfully storing its previous value in view state and restoring it on each postback. So the issue is this. If you want to go to your page and just say enable view state equals false, which is not a bad idea, usually, because that just eliminates view state for the entire page. And in fact, I know some developers that do this on an application-wide basis. You can go into your configuration file and just say disable view state, right? I want nothing to do with it. And of course, you can never fully get rid of view state. It's always there just a little bit to keep around page level state information. But it was significantly reduced. Okay. Now, the problem is if we go back and do some postbacks, like I'm doing here, notice my span is suddenly broken. So the view state was disabled on the span, and it was no longer restoring the state across. Now, I'm sure you don't very often actually increment values inside of labels like I'm doing here. But there are certain scenarios where controls really do rely on view state to work properly. And it's just sort of an unfortunate thing in those scenarios where you need to figure out how to enable it. So what we often wanted was something like this, where you said enable view state equals true, right? Now, of course, this won't work because once you disable it at the page level, all bets are off for the rest of the page. You can't selectively re-enable it, right? So that's what they added in version 4, is the ability to do this. And the way you do it is not by using enable view state, because that has historical purpose now. You want to use it by setting view state mode equal to disable if we want to. The default is inherit, so whatever your parent actually has. And then I can go down to my label, and again, you don't use enable view state, but rather view state mode is equal to enabled. So with view state mode, you can selectively re-enable view state on individual controls. So actually, a model that I'm quite fond of now in version 4 is setting view state mode to disabled in my configuration file. So the entire site has view state disabled, and then just selectively re-enabling it on individual controls where I know that I'm going to have a problem if I don't have view state enabled. Okay, so my label's working. We look at the source code. I've still got a small amount of view state, although there's one more integer in there we know stored for the span. Okay, so small feature, but welcome, right? Nice new best practice to follow. Okay, speaking of things that people have asked for, especially as developers are doing more client-side work in ASP.NET, one thing that's frustrating about working with ASP.NET, especially the server-side control model, is that the control identifiers are always generated using these concatenations of parent control names and somewhat arbitrary strings injected into the controls. So what you can do in this release is you can set the client ID mode of a particular control to one of three values. It can either be static, static, predictable, inherit, or auto ID. Auto ID is the same as it was before. So if you're using auto ID, which I can do a quick demo of here, let's specify client ID mode equal to auto ID on this particular label that I generated for the sum. And if we go run that, because I'm inside of a master page, let's go down to my label, sum. There it is. So you can see the identifier of that label, even though I called it underscore sum label, was generated as control 00 underscore main content underscore sum label. So it used my identifier, but not until the very end. How many of you have run into problems with this trying to do client-side script? Almost everyone, yes, yes. So it is a pain point in the current release. So you've got two options now, if this is a pain point for you. You can either do this. I'll get out of view source. You can either do this, which is set client ID mode to static. And static says, keep your dirty paws off my IDs. Right? So I know what I'm doing. Don't mess with it. And if we go look at the source here, look at my span, which is sum. There it is. And notice it was exactly what I typed into the markup for my label. So it ignored the containing control. It ignored the master page. It didn't put the little prefix on. So it did exactly what we told it to do, use the label. So that's nice. If you're doing JavaScript now, it's much easier to know exactly what the client ID is without having to go to some server-side function to retrieve the client ID, which is the only way to do it in the past. So that's one way to do it. Another way, which is the default, by the way, is to set it to predictable. Isn't that a great name? Predictable. I love it. As opposed to what it used to be. And what predictable is, it is if you do a static analysis of the containment of your control and its surrounding and its parent controls, you should be able to figure out what that control's ID is going to be, right? So they're not going to sprinkle any more arbitrary strings in there. It's just going to be the identifier of the parent underscore the identifier of you and on up the chain if you have multiple parents. So in our case, because we're inside of this content placeholder in the master page, that is our parent control. So the identifier for this control should be main content underscore some label. So you can use that assumption in your client-side script and actually make sure that you target the right thing. So let's go do this again, look for sum, there it is. And notice the value of sum is now, or the identifier, is now main content underscore underscore sum label. So that's kind of a compromise, right? The danger of just using the static version is that there was a reason for this prefixing of identifiers, and that is if you're in JavaScript and you have multiple identifiers that are the same, they're all going to be acted upon, which you probably don't want. You probably want to have unique references to individual elements in the client. Okay, now there's one other scenario that's interesting, and that is what if you're in the context of a field, a data-bound field, like I am right here? So let me change this. Let me actually use the designer, just because this will save me some typing. I'm going to change this to get back out of end template editing. I'm going to change one of these columns, edit columns, this guy right here, to a template column. And I'm going to go in and modify the template now. Edit templates. And there's my label. Okay, good. All right, let's go to the source. And what I did was I changed my ID field to be a template column. And notice I have this label here, which I want to use. So I'm going to call this underscore movie underscore ID. So that's the identifier that I would like to use. And since I am doing, let me call this the movie grid up at the top. So using that predictable identifier naming, which you get by default, that's the default in version 4, what we should see is main content underscore underscore movie grid underscore underscore movie ID, but we've got a bit of a problem here, right? What are we going to see for this movie ID, would you suspect? When the template gets bound. Yeah, it's got to have some unique identifier at the end, so probably just a integer value dropped in the end. And that is the default, so it's going to do a sequential value on the end of this thing. If you look at the identifier right here, notice these guys were generated with ID underscore 0, ID underscore 1, et cetera, et cetera. The problem comes when you're doing pagination, and we go down and look at those identifiers again. Notice it restarted. So we have 0, we have 1, we have 2, et cetera. So it's actually a little bit tricky to write some JavaScript against this, because you have to understand what page you're on if you have paging enabled, and know which of these elements was what order it was in a particular rendering sequence. So they added another feature, which is handy. You can go to a control. Any of the data-bound controls that enumerate templates like this have a new property called client ID row suffix. And what client ID row suffix is an identifier that drops into the current row in the result set and plucks out that value to use as the suffix of the control. So I can put in movie ID here, which happens to be the primary key column for that row, and it should drop in the identifier of that movie in the database as the suffix. Of course, I'm ordering by primary key right now, so let me page ahead. Here we go. Just to show you. Okay, there we go. So there's my movie identifiers. Notice they're all suffixed, not with the ordinal sequence of the rendering order, but rather with the primary key inside of the database. So that's a very well-defined relationship that you could actually build some client-side code against, right? If you understand the database that you're interacting with. Okay, so that's client ID. Welcome addition. Session state. So how many of you currently use session state in your applications? Ooh, lots. Yeah, okay. So Microsoft, every time I talk to the team, they say, well, we're just going to start ignoring session state now and hope that people stop using it and we just don't have to worry about it anymore. But every time they go out into the field, and actually even internally at Microsoft, like the Microsoft Office team, they're always coming back to them and saying, could you make session state a little bit faster? Could you give us a nice big red button that we could just push and that will make everything faster and smaller in our session state? So that's what they did in this release. They decided to spend a little more time working on it. And let me just ask one more question about session state. How many of you use the ASP.NET 2 version feature which lets you store it out of process, either in a database or in a service? So a few of you, okay, yeah. So this is for you guys, right? Those of you that are storing your session state out of process in a SQL Server database or in the service that you can configure, there are now some options for compression, which you'll probably want to enable so that you get this feature right here. So in your session state element, in your config file, you can specify compression enabled equals true, and this basically does a gzip on the binary before it exports it out to either SQL Server or the state server, and then undoes it on the backside. And they've done some testing on this, and they find that you get quite a bit of reduction because session state tends to be very text-oriented data, and compression works quite well. So they were seeing, I can't find my mouse, there it is. They were seeing on the order of a third to two-thirds size reduction, which really decreases the amount of the packet size on the network, which is nice, and improves the overall retrieval. Also, they've given the ability to programmatically enable and disable session state. So those of you that are using session state, especially out of process, one thing you typically have wanted to do in the past is go into individual pages and specify whether or not session state is actually used on that page, or if it's just read-only, right? Those are two settings you can put on the page attribute. And that's very important when you're doing out-of-process session state, because if you have a page that doesn't use it, why bother going out to your state server, pulling back the data, and then just letting it sit there, and then flushing it back when no changes have been made? So that has always been possible as a declarative attribute on the page directive. It is now possible programmatically. So if at runtime you can figure out that you're not going to be using session state, you can actually flip that on or off. Okay, another handy little feature they've added, which is again one of the lower level things, is the scenario is this, that you have multiple ASP.NET applications hosted within a single app pool inside of IIS. And if you have problems with memory utilization or CPU utilization, and you need to try to identify which process, which ASP.NET application is causing those problems, in today's environment, it's not that easy, because you can get process-level information about CPU utilization and memory consumption from Perfmon, and you can add trackers for that. But there's no way to do individual tracking of the app domains that ASP.NET allocates for the applications within the app pool. So they've introduced something called ARM in CLR4. Stands for Application Domain Resource Management. And basically, they added some tracking at the app domain level within ASP.NET, so that the memory utilization and CPU utilization, specifically those two, just CPU and memory, can be tracked on a per application, per app domain basis within the process. And it's very easy to use. The one thing you need to know to get these to use these things is you have to turn this on on because it is not on by default. This does incur a bit of additional overhead in the processing of an ASP.NET application within an app pool. So by default, it's off, and you really want to leave it off on your production sites unless you do have a problem which you're trying to diagnose, and this might be useful to help you diagnose it. So turn it on when you need to, turn it back off when you're done. And the place to do this, this is not in the core root config file, web.config. It's actually in a separate configuration file called the ASP.NET config file. Anyone ever use this file, ASP.NET config? It's up in the root of system? No, not many people have. So there are actually some settings you can get in here which are useful to know about. So here's the directory structure for where this thing is. It's Windows, Microsoft.NET Framework, 64 or 32, whichever you're in, and then version 4.0, et cetera. So it's at the root level. It's not within the config directory. And then what you can do is open up this ASP.NET ASP.NET config entry, and it's got a bunch of low-level features here that you can tweak that all affect ASP.NET's runtime behavior within the application pool. And the one I was talking about is this right here, app domain resource monitoring, and it is not there by default. You don't even see it with a enabled equals false. You have to actually type it in to get this working. So you need to go into this file, open it up as an administrator, type it in, save the file, restart the app pool, because it doesn't pick up changes to this file like a standard config file does, and then you'll have it in place and running. So let's go try it. I'm going to go bring up another instance of Visual Studio as an admin this time, so I can launch it, so I can create something on HTTP. So I'm going to set this as HTTP, and I'm going to create a new site called Baseline. And let's just do an empty site. Well, let's do it. Yeah, empty. Okay, empty site. And let's add a single page to the site. And in this page, what I want to do is I want to try monitoring the CPU. So I'm going to put in a little bit of CPU utilization on this page. So for int I equals 0, I less than 1,000 maybe, I plus plus. And let's just do some silly increment, like int j equals 0. And we're going to run this in debug mode so we don't have to worry about this stuff being optimized away. So j plus equals I maybe. OK, so there's a little bit of CPU usage every time this this site gets hit. And let's go create, let me just build that. Let's go create another application. Same idea. And this one's going to be CPU hog. Okay. And this guy is going to use a slightly larger counter. That's good. Let's just put an H1 in here, CPU hog, so I know which one is which. And let's do the same idea. Let's go in and say for int I equals 0, I less than 10,000 maybe. And for j equals 0, j less than j plus plus. And let's do k plus equals, no, not that, I times j. So we'll do a little CPU activity, a little more on this page. OK. Anyone else write their pages like this? You do the nested loops just for fun occasionally? No, not so much? OK, good. So here's the deal. Let's go run this page. There's my CPU hog. And let me go to my other site, which was Baseline. So I'm going to bring that up over here. So Baseline. OK, so there's Baseline. So they're both running now, and they should both be in the default app pool, because I use the same mechanism for creation. And what I should be able to do then is go to Performance Monitor and use these new performance counters. So let's go add a performance counter. And the place you want to look is under ASP.NET Applications. And I'll zoom in here so you can see what I'm looking at. The applications right here, there's the new one. So there are two new ones that were added for ASP.NET applications. There are a whole bunch in here for general ASP.NET things, which can be useful as well. But one of them is Manage Processor Time. And here's the important thing to note. Once I select that particular performance counter, it was able to look at the current app pools that were running and display all the app domains within each of those app pools. So I can add monitoring on a per app domain basis and not just a per process basis. So let's add one for my baseline, add him. And let's add one for the CPU hog, add him. And there's another one for memory consumption, as I mentioned. And let's make the width of these guys nice and big, and let's change the color so they contrast and set the scale. 0.1 should be fine. And do the same thing for this guy. Make them thick, and 0.1. OK, so I've got something running. Let's go try refreshing my CPU hog a couple times and my baseline a couple times. And let me change my scale. I think it needs to be a 1. And that should give us some feedback. OK, one more time. There's my baseline. There's my CPU hog. Well, someone blipped. There we go. Which one was that? That was my, no, that was, okay, that was the CPU hog. So I don't think I did enough CPU. Let's hit this guy harder. There we go. All right, so we're getting some activity. My baseline guy should have done more work, but you get the idea, right? So you can monitor these things on a per application basis instead of just the per process basis. And if you've got someone that's hogging memory or using CPU too much, you can identify which of the two or which of the app domains loaded within your process is the one that's causing the problems quite easily. Okay, so keep that in mind. Nice new diagnostic feature introduced in version 4. Okay, here's a really short one. Permanent redirect. So in your pages, which I'm sure you've run across before, just call this a redirect page, like so. If in here you want to do a redirect, you could always do response.redirect and just give it default.aspx, let's say. And that will generate a temporary redirection, right? And the problem was if you wanted to do a permanent redirection, like you actually did a bunch of physical file moves and you wanted to do this programmatically, there was no way to do it. Well, there are ways, but you had to resort to actually setting the error of the response code yourself and doing it. So now there's a function, redirect permanent. And if I go turn on tracing so you can see what's happening here, and I go to my redirect page, redirect.aspx. What did I call it? RedirectPage.aspx. Okay, clear that. So redirectPage.aspx, like so. Okay, so we got redirected. And let me just show you the actual response, which is right here. So we got a 301 instead of a temporary one. So this is a permanent redirect, and the search engines will respond appropriately, right? Okay, small feature, but makes your life easier if you've been trying to do that. Here's another really small feature, but again, you might have been reaching for this in the past. You can now set meta keywords and meta description properties on a page directive, or you can do it programmatically as well. These just turn into meta entries in your rendered page. So if I go up here and I say meta description, my meta description, and meta keywords, K1, K2, K3, run the page, and you can look at the meta that was added right here. So there's the meta description and the meta keywords just injected into the header. Okay, so again, something you could have done before, but you would have had to write a little code and actually inject it into the head element yourself. Okay, chart control. So they have this, they packaged this nifty new chart control into ASP.NET now. And honestly, the best way to explore this control is to download the associated set of demos that come with the chart control that you can download. If you just go to www.asp.net, you'll find a link to downloading the chart control. And they have a set of demos which actually target Visual Studio 2008, so you can use this chart control within that environment as well. And that's going to take a moment to compile. While it does that, let me just show you what it looks like on the designer. So if I go over here, notice under data, I now have a chart control as an option. Okay, and you can drag that guy on. And they've actually done a really nice job in building out the designers for these things. So you can come in and you can specify data collections and all the different types of charts that you might want to render, et cetera. And basically what this thing will do is it will render the chart based on data you specify on the server and then send up a PNG image by default to render. Or you can specify JPEG if you want as well. Anyway, here's the sample that you get when you download the chart control. And these are really nice because they give you sort of a quick idea of what's possible. These are all live charts that were built using this chart control. And not only that, but it also gives you the source code on how they render the chart. So if you want to use a chart, I'd recommend just going into this collection of samples on the site here, choose the one you want, and then go grab the source code from it, and off you go. And just to give you a sense for some of the things that are possible here, notice that we also have interactivity and AJAX built into it. So down here, you can do things like real-time chart. So that's demonstrating doing real-time plotting with callbacks using AJAX. You can do click event. So down here, every time I click on one of the elements, it triggers an event, which I can then capture and do something in response to. Again, these are all AJAX-based events, so it doesn't affect server-side postbacks. You can do custom tooltips on client-side script. There we go. So as I hover over these things, we get little image tooltips popping up. So, you know, lots of stuff here. So if you want to play around with the chart control, install or download those demos and run through that some of those samples, and I'm sure you'll find something among there then that will satisfy your needs. Okay, here's another sort of small feature, but a welcome one. I don't know how many of you have done this before. Let me open up my demo that I was starting earlier. Web samples? No. No, this one here. So the one I had before was on demos, test routing. Maybe that's where I was. Right, this one had the grid in it, which is what I wanted. No, it didn't. Okay, we're going to do it from scratch here. So let's throw the grid on one more time. Here's the issue that was often complained about, which is if you have a grid like this and you turned on paging and selection specifically, and let's change the format to be something a little more interesting so we can see it. What happens by default with selection and paging is if you select a row and then you go to a different page, it maintains that selection as an offset to the first element of the page, which is not usually what we mean when we say keep that row selected, right? Selecting row 3 doesn't usually mean select 33 as well, if I go through pagination. So there's a new attribute on the grid view, the list view, some other of those data-bound controls, where you can specify enable persisted selection. So enable persisted selection equals true. And that adds just the right amount of little state information so that when you select something and do page navigation, it keeps that selection for you and doesn't actually propagate it across different pages. So again, a small feature, but one that's welcome and a lot of people have struggled with in the past to find an easy way to do it in your own implementations. Okay, another nice feature they've introduced is a new control that's used in combination with dynamic data, but you can also use it standalone with entity data sources or SQL data, link data sources. And this is a query extender control. And let me just open up a project I have ready to go that already has an entity framework ready to go. Okay, and this is a solution file. Hold on. Open the solution file. Query extender. Okay, so this project has a grid view that's displaying data from a the movie reviews database. And what I'd like to do is give the user the ability to do some filtering on the contents. So a very common thing you might want to do is to do sorting, for example. And you also might want to do something more interesting like perhaps range filtering. So in this example, what I was doing was showing movie reviews, and maybe I want to show all the movie reviews that are rated between, you know, 7 and 10 or something, and set up a filter like that. And what's interesting is that with the entity data source and the link to SQL data source, we have the capability of performing those types of operations because link, you know, provides those filtering capabilities. But we have no way of doing this declaratively today. So the only way to do that in the past was to go in and actually modify the link query in your code and have that be reflected in the result. So what I can do is let me just show you the range query because that's the most interesting one. So show reviews between, and let's put a text box in here, and we'll give this an ID of low range. Two, another text box, which is going to be high range. So this will be high range. Okay, and then I want to put a button on, so we actually trigger the search, so filter. And then the way we're going to do this is I'm going to go associate a new query extender right here, query extender, and I'm going to associate it with my entity data source. So you create this new control, the query extender, and you specify the target control ID equal to the linked data SQL or entity data source data source. And then inside of here, we can specify a range expression and specify a max a data field, which is going to be what was my rating. Rating, like so. And then within the range expression, we can specify the control parameter. And the first control is going to be control ID of low range, like so. And the next one's going to be high range control ID. So high range, like so. And what that will do is take advantage of the fact that we're pointing to an entity data source which is capable of doing filtering with ranges, and map the value of those two controls into this range expression and apply it to the rating field in the data source. Let me just make sure that's the right name. Yep, rating field right there. And it should restrict the results of that corresponding entity data source to the subset of values that were specified by the client. I need to specify the type of the range that I'm doing. So that was right here. So max type equals inclusive, and min type will do the same thing. So that's whether you want to include the bound at the top or the bottom. Okay, so let's show all reviews between 7 and 10 inclusive, filter them, and notice my reviews now are all only the ones that fall within that range. So there's several different types of filtering you can do. It's all declarative, so you can do searches, you can do ranges, you can do property checkboxes, whether something is true or false, to very easily filter based on a checkbox selection. And you can also do a custom one, which you map into your own function and then apply your own link query to alter it. So a very nice way to filter declaratively. Okay, one quick thing, the browser capabilities file. How many of you have sort of dug around in the .browserfiles directory up under Microsoft.net browsers? Anyone done that? Not too many, but a couple. Yeah, so the problem with the current release is, and this has been a problem for a while, they had the browser capabilities defined in these browser files, and they had a little note at the top that said, this is going to be maintained by some third party that's going to generate new browser files from time to time. And it turns out that never quite came to fruition, and we never had updated browser files, so that it was more community-oriented. People started supplying their own, so we could identify new browsers as they came out. So they just took a step back, and they went back and redesigned this to be simpler and up-to-date, right? It's basic story. So what all you need to know is that when you query the request.browser property now, it will correctly tell you whether it's Chrome or Firefox and which version, or whether it's an iPhone or whether it's a mobile Windows device. And you can also query more detailed information like, is it a mobile device? And what model of mobile device is it? And does it support XML HTTP request objects? So you can very quickly find these things out. All that's information is stored in the browser files and is part of the browser object when you work with them. Okay. The other thing they've added... And they sort of had to add this because every release of ASP.NET has come with a new evaluation or new expression syntax. The first release was traditional ASP. We had percent %equals, right? And then we had data binding in ASP.NET, which was percent hash sign. And then we had the resource symbol for build expressions in version 2. And now we have HTML encoded code expressions. So what you can do in your pages now is you can actually put in... something like this, percent %equals, instead of percent %equals, I could say script alert hi script. Okay, so if we did this, and assuming that was coming from somewhere that the user entered, right? We'd be in trouble because the user just injected some script into our site. But if you use this, that's the new syntax, and you want to think of this as kind of like a squish down equal sign, right? So they just compressed it down, and what this will do now is do HTML encoding for you. So notice it properly encoded that script content before it sent it back to the client. And there's just one other thing to know about. So the idea behind this new syntax is that you should really prefer it all the time. So just try to get in the habit of using percent colon instead of percent equals. And this is especially true for MVC applications, where you tend to use these expressions much more. Very important to do HTML encoding of all the content that you're rendering back to the user. So this is a nice short way to do it. And if you ever want to escape, but you still want to use the colon syntax, you can actually use this HTML string class, construct a new instance, put the string in there, and it won't HTML encode it, even though you're putting it into a percent colon syntax. So I know it feels a little weird, but at least that lets you use percent colon everywhere. So you can use that as like a coding standard that you enforce, and then make the exception just, you know, constructing a class that exempts it on the fly. So that's nice. CSS improvements. As I mentioned, a bunch of improvements were made in CSS. One of the immediate ones you'll see is that when you run an application that actually has a menu up here, look at how the menu is built. Let's find the menu. Menu. Right here. Yeah, there's a menu. About home. Here we go. Okay, so you see that? Someone tell me how this is different from the rendering of the menu in previous versions of ASP.NET. What did it used to be?
Table,
yeah, right. So isn't this great? By default, it's no longer a table, which a lot of people have been asking for. And it was not easy to take an existing menu and actually render it as a table unless you're using some control builder thing, but most people didn't want to get into that. So they've changed a lot of these controls to use list-oriented rendering with CSS instead of the traditional tables. And you'll see they fixed a lot of the issues. I just list a few of them up here. So controls don't render borders anymore. They don't surround things with tables if they don't have to. And they actually render XHTML conformance set to strict. So just a lot of nice little enhancements to these controls. Having said that, you may find that some of this stuff breaks some of your default assumptions about how these controls work. And if you're migrating to 4.0, there is a way to sort of tell it to go back to 3.5 by setting the control rendering compatibility version to 3.5. And that will not use all these new rendering techniques. But for the most part, it shouldn't really affect how your stuff works. It'll just, you know, be CSS-driven instead of traditional table-driven. And real quick, list view, now you don't have to use a layout template. It's optional, so it behaves like any other data-bound control that has an item template. Checkbox list and radio button list support list rendering instead of tables, right? Imagine that, a control that's called list actually renders a list. And the menu control, like I just told you, renders that. And we are out of time. So, perfect. So that's a list of some of the new features. Again, the big one in ASP.NET 4 is routing. A lot of other little features that hopefully just make your life easier and move things in the right direction. I will be down here for questions if you have any, please approach me. Also, if you're interested in a free week trial to Pluralsight's on-demand service, please come down and ask for a card, and thank you all for coming.